Charles will be delighted to answer any questions.
Yes. How would libertarians define a healthy national immigration policy? A classic example of you can't do, you have to do two things at one time. The first law of libertarian reform, according to Charles Murray's, is that every increase in freedom must be accompanied by a corresponding increase in responsibility for the consequences of behavior. So if you take away the welfare state, you have a, an immigration policy where I say have the open doors, because what you attract to this country historically has been energy and vitality, and I think has kept this nation young and alive. If you have an extensive welfare state and then you add on to that an immigration policy which gives preference for the relatives of people who are already here, you no longer have a situation in which a man is picking himself up from his country, wrenching himself away from everything he knows, and coming to make his way in the new world. You rather have a guy who's been sent an airline ticket by Joe and then can come over and stay at his place while he sees how he likes it over here. And of course, if he doesn't like it over here, he can he has a more generous welfare state than he has back in his own home country. You have a very different self-selection policy. So your answer is, as things stand right now, I say that a rational immigration policy has to be one which has some restrictions, and I don't think you can open up borders under the way we have it now. And so in that sense, I say you have a legitimate police function for the state, but I'm very sad about that, because I would much rather have a situation in which the words on the Statue of Liberty still apply, because I think it has made this nation great. That refers to Broadway books. That's the printer's imprint. So it's an innocuous. There's no cabalistic meaning to that whatsoever. Yeah. Could I comment on Prop 209 and Ebonics? I have for many years felt as deeply as anything that strong affirmative action has been one of the most pernicious policies this country has pursued. And I would go through that in detail, but I believe that as deeply as I believe anything. Whether you're talking about measures of progress for blacks, whether you're talking about racial hostility, all the rest. The idea that it could be declared unconstitutional, that Prop 209 could be declared unconstitutional, is to me deeply depressing. Ebonics, look, I come from a town where we have Appalachian white kids who need to speak correct English if they're ever going to get anywhere in the world. And if it could be shown to me that it really worked to take kids and work with them in the incorrect English they use in order to get them to speak correct English, I'm enough of a pragmatist to say, okay. As far as I know, that's not true. My more general statement is that I think that one of the things that has been most damaging to education in general and to black kids in particular has been saying, oh, it's okay, we don't expect much from you. I think high expectations, no-nonsense expectations are the way to go. Black, white, Asian, whatever. Way at the back there. Well, you know, I would like to do some empirical work here, because it's my impression. Think back 20, 25 years. We all know that the amount of money spent on campaigns at that time was much lower. All right. When you had virtually no restrictions whatsoever on what people could give. And you also had some people who gave lots and lots of money. On the one hand, you can be pretty sure in those cases that if you have a guy who's given, you know, $1 million to a candidate, that probably that elected congressman is not going to directly vote against the interests of the person who gave him the $1 million. I think in the sense that influence has been bought, I think that's probably true. But I think it's also historically true that people who were the big campaign contributors weren't calling up their congressman every day to get the congressman to vote their way on particular votes. That it was much more broad, diffuse kind of support. It is my view, but it is not one in which I have done a lot of work. It's my impression that the campaign reform laws which have attempted to limit money have had the effect of intensely focusing the money on certain issues. So now it is true that for every issue that comes up, the congressman is voting in response to some very direct pressures by people whose money he needs. I'm in favor of free speech, and I consider that giving money to a candidate is no different in terms of free speech than Barbara Streisand having a fundraising concert at which she sings and gets other people to give her money. And I don't think that restricting the amount of money that a person can give is an appropriate thing for the government to do. I also believe, as a pragmatic matter, that if you simply get rid of all the campaign financing laws, period, that you are not going to have an explosion in more money coming into these campaigns, and you're not going to have an explosion of special interests. I think exactly the opposite. I think this is a classic case of the government trying to stage manage something where every time it tries to do something, it backfires on it. And having said that so emphatically, I really need to do a lot more work before I'm absolutely sure I'm right on all that. But I do want to look into it. Yeah, back there. No, come up here. Would a libertarian society be good or bad for the environment? One of my favorite chapters in the book is on the environment. A couple of quick comments. For a great many environmental issues, I think extension of private property rights rather than restriction is the way to go. One of the things that human beings do best is act as stewards of things they own, and one of the things they do worst is act as stewards of things they don't own. And that is a phenomenon that each of us has observed in our lives, in things we have owned and things we have rented. Who washes a rental car? It's true of the houses. It's true of... I shouldn't be so flip. It's true of all kinds of things. A great deal of what happened bad to the environment was a retreat from appropriate tort law in the 19th century in the name of greater industrialization. It became okay to dump effluents into the rivers, even though you were making trouble downstream, and because they wanted economic growth. Well, it seems to me that it was appropriate then and it's appropriate now to say, look, if you dump something into the water, you've committed a nuisance in tort law, and you are liable for it. Having said that, I also think that there are aspects of the environment that lend themselves to the classic definition of a public good. Clean air is a good example. If we're talking about one smokestack emitting noxious fumes, then you can go to tort law. If you're talking about 100 smokestacks, then I think that there is an appropriate place for saying you have a non-segmentable public good in which a certain government regulation is appropriate. I say that, and then I also say that this legitimate function has been performed by the federal government in idiotic ways, and by local governments too. So I would have huge reforms in the way we go about this, but I think there is a role to be played by the government in protecting the environment. You've had your hand up a long time here.
Historically, in this country, libertarians like the tropical creative assistant led to the Civil War, and in Europe, prior to 1914, libertarians created a system which leads to...
Wait a minute. Libertarians created the system which led to the Civil War? Okay, go ahead.
And in Europe, prior to the First World War, the same type of libertarians led to systems that created totalitarian regimes. So how would your system avoid both these pitfalls?
This reminds me of a lot of the discussion of the bell curve. I'm serious, sir, where first I got to say, no, I'm not beating my wife, and then I've got to say that there was a great flaw, a tragic flaw in the Aristotelian sense, I think, in the creation of this country, in which it was thought that you could have a free society coexist with slavery. But slavery was not a libertarian principle, and the people who created this country did not say, oh, we think slavery is great, we want to keep it. It was, well, Thomas Jefferson himself was forced to remove from the Declaration of Independence, a reference to wanting, the reference which would talked about getting rid of slavery. They made a huge mistake, but it was not libertarian principles that produced the Civil War. And I would also, we'd have to talk for a long time before I understood your relationship between libertarian governments and the totalitarian governments of the early part of the century. I suppose it has to do with the immiseration of the poor or that sort of thing. And there I think we'd have some serious empirical arguments. Too big a question for me to deal with in full. Yes?
If public education is a public good, what's the best way to pay for it, especially for the children of the poor?
In the book, I say vouchers, unrestricted voucher. I have to tell you, the question was, what's the best way to deal with education if it's a public good? How to pay for it? And I said vouchers. There is a very serious set of arguments on that. I cited Milton Friedman in Pursuit as my foundation for being in favor of vouchers, unrestricted vouchers, whereupon Professor Friedman wrote me a lovely, long letter saying that I had correctly cited him, but he'd since changed his mind. And I wrote him a letter back saying, Professor Friedman, I'm in a position of not being able to answer your arguments, but I'm still not persuaded. So I'm sticking with vouchers. Yeah.
Several months ago, the Chronicle, in fact, some of you may have seen, had a story about the high price of marijuana in San Francisco. We had a picture of a guy named Jake down on the page. He said, well, the price has gotten so high, I can hardly afford it to come out there. I sent a letter back to Billy Brown and some other people and said, gee, as a taxpayer, why can't I afford a drug test? We're all on welfare. We didn't see if I could pay for the taxpayer. But it seems like a logical way to control the use of drugs was they're picking it up.
Well, and so the question has to do with why not be able to require drug testing of welfare recipients, and I have heard similar arguments made. Why shouldn't it be appropriate to require young women who are on welfare to have Norplant? Now, on the one hand, I will grit my teeth and say, if you have a government benefit, it is not a right, and the government may attach to that benefit whatever requirements it wishes, including, well, drug testing or Norplant or whatever. And I say that, gritting my teeth, because I think that is symptomatic of the way we may end up going. Because that really is opening the doors to a really authoritarian degree of intrusion into people's lives, which starts from an appropriate premise, but then, well, if we can require Norplant for young women on welfare, why not? And then you can sort of imagine for yourself the extensions. And with regard to that, let me say that one of my, you know, I've given you a fairly optimistic look at what's possible today. One of the things that scares me most about contemporary liberalism is the degree of cognitive dissonance that is involved. Where you have large numbers of, and I'm talking about a lot of academics and intellectuals with whom I have had variety of contacts, who are saying one thing, and they will talk about the injustices of the American criminal justice system and how it oppresses blacks and about how it does this, that, and the other thing, but you can be damn sure they are living in safe suburbs to which they have moved. And they will talk about the importance of the public school system and the way it's been the democratizing force in the United States, and you can be damn sure that their kids go to schools that they think are good, and if they have to be private, so be it. So you have this kind of cognitive dissonance where they're saying one thing and thinking another. And the psychologists will tell you that when cognitive dissonance is finally resolved, because it does create internal tensions of very large proportions, when it is resolved, it is not resolved by people calmly going toward the middle. It tends to go, you know, the fervor of the newly converted. And I see, and I'm not trying to demonize the left here. I believe this. I see a real danger of an authoritarian reaction in this country in which certain elements of the right are joined enthusiastically by members of the left. And so in many ways, proposing a free society is something that seems to me even more urgent now than before. Yes?
Do you think of a way to popularize these ideas and have a culture, especially one that's
that's sort of why I wrote the book. It really is true that I hope that this book makes the word libertarian not so flaky. I really hope that it helps contribute to a broader understanding of this way of looking at the world. And I think the first step in doing all of that is to engage in a dialogue. I think that libertarians have had a tendency in the past, because they do have a very strong set of principles upon which you can erect an isolated, correct theoretical structure. So you can say A points to B points to C points to D, the same way that the Marxists could, and that libertarians have tended to argue that way. And so when it comes to drug legalization, for example, they have started out with the principle of thou shalt do not have the right to interfere with someone else's right to harm himself, and have not been willing to come to grips with the question, well, but how do you deal with the collateral effects? So the talk about a trite answer, but I think it is to engage in a dialogue where you are trying to come straight to grips with the concerns that people who aren't libertarians have. Yes, the back. I've got two people. Excuse me. We'll go in order. Yeah. It's just so I irritate the people who are coming after me. It's really true. It's really true. If I thought I could get away with getting angry, I mean, I feel angry a lot of times, but it makes them real mad when I don't get angry. And so, and the one behind there. I'll repeat the main point of the question was referring to the clause in the Bill of Rights, which says that all rights not specifically enumerated in the Constitution are reserved to the states and the people respectively. They're the 9th and 10th amendments actually to it. Robert Bork refers to them as inkblots now. And I think as a correct statement of constitutional jurisprudence, that's about true. They simply have no meaning. You take something like the Interstate Commerce Clause, which says, you know, the federal government shall have the power to regulate commerce among the states, which sort of meant you can't put up toll bridges between the states. And that now is the justification for virtually any kind of federal intervention. And similarly with other aspects of the Constitution, those two things don't mean anything. The Constitution, we're in big trouble on constitutional interpretation. Yeah. The question is how you keep vouchers from becoming a desperate trap and destroying the private school system, in effect. That is such a serious question that when I say I'm for vouchers, and I think I actually have the sentence in italics in the book, they must be wholly unrestricted. But as you're shaking your head, I see why you're shaking your head, all right? Because you can see all the ways in which that can be gotten around. I just don't have a pat answer for you. I think all we can do is say, look, it's important that poor children have a shot at a good education. And this is one of the best ways to do it. And then trumpet loud and clear the fact that the government must stay out of regulating the schools. But I'm very sympathetic with your statement. Yeah. Public education offers a substantial offer to the I think the climate of the future. Why not just abolish the whole damn thing?
what the parents think about the kids in the world. They pay the whole price. If they have to homeschool, fine. I mean, come on. 75% of adults do not, you know, have any kids anymore, whatever. So just get rid of them and get that government out of it.
Well, Milton Friedman, in this letter to me, let me go on, because it relates to this. He said, look, the reason that education is a public good is because you can't run a democracy without an educated electorate. But where he changed his mind was, he said, it is quite obvious from history, including some of this history that I cited in Pursuit, that even absent a government-financed educational system, you would have a very high proportion of people being educated, and you would achieve the public good without state financing. Furthermore, to reinforce your point, I don't think it is the case that if you got rid of state financing that you would then have poor children who wouldn't have a chance for education. It's fascinating to read in the earliest schools established in the United States, long before the Common School Movement, the degree to which it was taken for granted that there was provision made for children whose parents could not afford to pay the fees. Okay, now, I've said all that. And it comes down to a narrow choice, and where I come down is as follows: children are different from adults. There are all sorts of ways in which the inequalities visited upon children cannot be redressed by the states, by the government. I don't want to get the government involved in many of them. As I look at education, I say that's one area in which it is appropriate for children that there be a method that we can be sure that there is an opportunity out there for everybody. If you want to say to me you think that that would also be out there as well without state financing, I think that's an important argument to have. I come down on that side, mainly because children are involved.
One last question.
Yes. It's an amazing thing about the last question. They're always one like this. I mean, it's the question, isn't this just one more, the guys who have it say, oh, let's have this libertarian society, because what that'll do is enable them to secure theirs and leave the others behind. And in fact, the New York Times review of my book says that the bell curve is actually in contradiction to the happy prospect in this book. A theme I did not go into, because I did it at the last time I spoke before the Independent Institute, is that it is precisely in order to provide satisfying lives for a wide range of people that you need to have vastly decentralized functions. That when I talked briefly about the satisfactions of life earlier, the question at the end of the bell curve that concerned Dick Hernstein and me was, forget about economics for a minute. Just ask yourself how it is that people who have the short end of the stick, whether it's in terms of intelligence or industriousness or charm or whatever else, how do you have a society in which there are a rich number of roles for those folks to fill? Authentically important roles. We call them valued places, so that they can reach this age of 70 and look back on who they have been and what they have done and be authentically satisfied with their lives. And we argued in the bell curve, and I argue in this book, and I also argued in Pursuit, that in order to do that, you come down to a few core roles. You come down to the core roles of spouse, parent, neighbor, friend. The only way to enrich those roles is to decentralize the kinds of functions which have been sent down to the bureaucracies. If you were then to say to me, oh, this is going to cause people starving in the streets and all sorts of other kinds of physical miseries, then I'd say, okay, you've got a point. Maybe we have to rethink whether we're going to do this. I will argue not only would that not be the case, it is precisely by this kind of a free society that you are once more in a post-industrial age going to have places that people can fill, that you are going to provide sources of satisfaction, that it's the people in this room who de facto live lives that are free enough already, and that it is precisely these other people to whom freedom has been denied and for whom the denial of that freedom has been most tragic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charles, and thank you, everyone, for joining with us. For those of you who haven't seen the book, this is Charles's new book. It's published by Broadway Books, which is part of Bantam. And if you're interested in a good personal and short read on the subject, I recommend it to you. We hope that you'll all join with us at our next Independent Policy Forum. Thank you very much for coming.